Hello to everyone in the US, Israel, Palestine, and other places in the world. Welcome to this latest installment of Conversations with Israel and Palestine, hosted by Partners for Progressive Israel. Conversations with Israel and Palestine is a series of informational webinars that brings voices from Israel and Palestine to an American audience, providing an important link between progressives in the US and in the Middle East. My name is Kayla Rothman-Zecker, and over the next 60 minutes, I'll be serving as a discussion moderator. I've worked for most of the past decade in Israel, Palestine, and the United States on refugee-related issues. While in Israel, I worked with HIAS Israel and the first pro bono legal aid program for refugees, as well as with the African Refugee Development Center on various refugee community initiatives. As a result, I am extremely familiar and so proud of the amazing work of our panelists today, and I'm very excited for you to hear from them in just a moment. Before we get started, let me note that Partners for Progressive Israel is an American non-for-profit 501c3 organization dedicated to the achievement of a durable and just peace between Israel and its neighbors, and believes in the need to ensure civil rights, equality, and social justice for all of Israel's inhabitants. Partners seek to deepen Americans, and especially American Jews, understanding of Israel's complexities in order to enhance their ability to advocate for a progressive Israeli future. Let me now introduce our two panelists for today. Mutasim Ali is a co-founder of the African Students Organization in Israel and a former executive director of the African Refugee Development Center in Israel. He is also the first Darfuri refugee to be recognized by Israel and given status. Mutasim attended law school in Israel and is currently getting his master's in law at George Washington University. Dr. Tali Kritzman-Amir is a visiting associate professor at Harvard University as an Israel Institute Fellowship recipient and a senior lecturer of immigration and international law at the College of Law and Business in Israel. She is one of the leading experts in Israel on immigration and asylum law and policy and has authored dozens of articles on the topic. Let me just add that the discussion will go on for about 40 minutes, after which we'll be answering questions from the video audience. I encourage you to type in your questions at any time. All you need to do is either run your mouse over your screen or touch your screen, and then click on the icon that says Q&A. Type your question in the small box that appears. The webinar won't disappear or be disrupted. Please note that viewers' microphones are turned off, and questions can only be asked when typed in this way. So, welcome, and I'm very excited to moderate this discussion today with two really, really, really phenomenal panelists, and let's get started. First, I thought that in order to understand a little bit more of the context of who a refugee is, what's unique about Israel in this sense, I wanted to ask Tali to start with sort of laying a bit of a foundation for us about who is coming into Israel, and why, and where do refugees fall within this context?
So thank you so much, Kayla, both for moderating and for this excellent question. I think, very important to think about the issue of refugees in Israel in its broader context, and keep in mind that there are also other categories of non-Jewish migrants in Israel. So, for example, Israel has about 200,000 migrant workers who come to Israel temporarily to work in specific sectors such as agriculture, construction, and the care sector. But what we will be focusing on today are the refugees. And we will be using that term quite loosely, even though it's defined in international law. Most of the people that we will be talking about today were never defined by the state of Israel as refugees. Nevertheless, we talk to them about refugees because we believe that substantively they meet the requirements of international law on this topic. And what international law says in the convention that was drafted in 1951, which Israel was one of the drafting parties to, is that refugees are people who, first of all, cross international border, and that their migration is inspired by a fear of a future-looking expectation of persecution, and that future-looking expectation of persecution needs to be connected, according to the definition, to one of five grounds that's specified in a convention, which are race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. So we have that definition in international law, but as we'll say later, Israel's been quite reluctant to implement it. Now, once a person is defined as a refugee, then that means that states have obligations towards that person. So unlike migrant workers, to whom states have quite a wide discretion on how to treat them, there are pretty precise obligations towards refugees in international law, the most important of which is the obligation to refrain from refouling them, refrain from returning them or removing them to a place where their lives or freedom would be jeopardized. So, I mean, I'm oversimplifying things, but I just want to say that we're talking about this particular group of refugees, which is just one of the few groups of non-Jewish migrants that we have in Israel.
Thank you. And that actually takes us to the topic we want to talk about today, about sort of the groups of refugees in Israel. And Tessema, I want to turn to you. But to lay this out, in 2007, the first group of Darfurian refugees arrived in Israel, and they camped out in the Rose Garden across from the Knesset. This was by no means the beginning of the war in Darfur. Similarly, the other large group of refugees who came from Eritrea only began arriving in Israel in 2009. Again, the situation in Eritrea that was causing people to seek safety elsewhere had started decades earlier. If you could help us understand a little bit why all of a sudden refugees started to come into Israel, and sort of speak specifically about the two main groups who are in Israel.
Thank you so much, Kayla, and I'm so glad and excited to be here with you, and also speaking to the audience who just joined us. And I think this day has two significance. One, it is my actually second day of the snow in my life, so I'm so excited. and number two, this is actually sixth year since the biggest march, a refugee march in Tel Aviv, to speak up for, you know, for basic rights to be treated in a humane way. And so, to your question, you know, as we know, most of the refugees and asylum seekers are coming from Sudan and Eritrea. These are the vast majority of refugees and asylum seekers, right? Of course, there are others from Western African countries, such as Ivory Coast, and there's some from Guinea and a few of Nigeria, say also. Speaking of Sudanese and Eritreans, because these are the two major groups in Israel, Sudanese are primarily coming from war-torn zones, primarily from Darfur, Nuba Mountains, and the Blue Nile. Why these specific regions? Because these are the regions that are, you know, undergoing persecution and oppression. And speaking of Darfur, and I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with the issue of Darfur. It started way back, but you know, the major events were basically in 2002, 2003, when the Sudanese central government launched a genocidal campaign to change the racial identity of the region Darfur. What do I mean by that? The vast majority of Darfuris are African ethnic groups. And the government wanted to change that racial component from African majority to Arab majority. And that's why we've seen thousands of villages were burned down and people were displaced and hundreds of thousands of refugees. And speaking of, you know, refugees in Darfur, Sudanese refugees in Israel, this is just a small portion of big refugee movement, especially Sudanese. In many neighboring countries. I would say there are over 300,000 refugees in Chad, you know, hundreds of thousands of refugees in Cameroon, Central African Republic, Uganda, Ethiopia, and all of these countries. And Israel, of course, you know, had it, you know, has its share. The other group, the other major group is Eritreans. And basically, of course, in Eritrea, there is no war, but then there is, grave human rights violation, indefinite, detention, military conscriptions, disappearances, rape, and all of these issues. And that's part of the reason why many Eritreans, leave their countries. And that's why we see a big percentage of Eritreans across the world are being recognized as refugees. Just to give you last information about this, there are about 29,600 refugees from Africa living in Israel today. This is like the current numbers. It does not include children for sure, but I think it is unfortunate that Israel cannot deal with or cannot handle less than 30,000 refugees living in its borders.
And just to follow up with that, the what changed that refugees started to come specifically into Israel? Because before, the destination country, which was often when seeking safety, a lot of these groups would end up in Egypt, and then from there to other places. But at some point, they started to come into Israel. If you could talk a little bit about that shift and perhaps your own decision to come to Israel as well.
Right. So the majority of refugees who made their way to Israel were also, as you said, in Egypt or in Libya. And what really happened, and I can tell you one example of why a lot of people, decided or had to leave and make it to Israel. So in 2005, this is one of the events, 2005 in Cairo, thousands of Sudanese refugees who actually sought asylum in Cairo because as their first country of arrival, they've been waiting there and their rights were violated. Others were sent back because of the diplomatic relationships between Sudanese and Egyptian government, solely because most of refugees are from Darfur, Nuba Mountain, Blue Nile. And these groups are labeled by the Sudanese government as Sudanese and actually Egyptian governments as security threats to the two countries. And that's part of the reason why a lot of people were subject to deportation, detention, and also disappearances. Because of those practices, a lot of people gathered in Cairo to protest for their rights, but also to see or ask the United Nations High Commission for Refugees to resettle them because Egypt was not a safe place for them. Apparently what happened is that 29 people were actually killed by the Egyptian security service. And that also applies to Libya because the reason why those countries, Libya and Egypt, I'm speaking specifically these countries, and probably some of the other countries like Jordan or Lebanon, we have a lot of people there because, there are, political or diplomatic relationships, right? And so that's part of the reason why people were under fear of deportation or even detention on those countries. And that's part of the reason why a lot of people decided to cross the Mediterranean, right? A lot of people decided to cross the Mediterranean and then the other part made their way to Israel. Here are the two main reasons for me personally why I made it to Israel. One is because of the, when the genocide began in Darfur and we had the displays and people, lost everything, their lives and almost lost hope. The only people were out there to speak for, for the people of Darfur were primarily Jewish diaspora, Jewish movements and synagogues and all of that, given the fact that, Jews have experienced one of, and this is not by activists who protested for Darfur, Save Darfur movement, that we have been there before and we cannot let it happen again. We will work with you. And all of these, all of those signs and movements were sort of giving an impression that Israel would be a safe place because of its being Jewish state. And the second reason is that especially for Sudanese, Israel does not have any diplomatic relationship. So if we fear deportation from Libya or Jordan or Cairo or Egypt, then that would not be the case simply because there is no diplomatic relationship between Sudan and Israel to this day. And that's part of the reason why a lot of people had to take that risk to make their way to Israel. And it wasn't that easy, really, decision to make, because in the end, we couldn't go to Egyptian or the Israeli embassy in Cairo and ask for permission to make it to Israel.
Thank you. As Mutasim mentioned, now there's about 29,000 refugees in Israel, but from the time when the refugees started to enter in 2007 until around 2012, there was an extreme influx of refugees, and it went up to nearly 60,000 people crossing the border. Talia, I wanted to ask you, in terms of Israel was a drafter of the convention, of the Refugee Convention. They were committed to the ideals of safety for Jewish people. And all of a sudden, we're tasked to sort of figure out how do we deal with asylum seekers from non-Jewish countries. And I think there's an interesting perspective from the beginning of when Israel started to deal with this and the general attitudes towards people who are coming in and how that sort of started to shift pretty dramatically, which manifested in some pretty terrible policies. But maybe if you could paint a little bit of a picture of sort of the struggle of Israel having to sort of create policies and legal mechanisms and justice systems to sort of how to cope with the influx of refugees.
Yeah, so I've mentioned before that Israel was one of the drafters of the 1951 convention. And at the time, Israel had an interest in a convention because the idea was that the convention would probably protect Jewish refugees in the post-World War II era. But the historical research about Israel at that time suggests that Israel didn't actually think that it would be in a position to have to take non-Jewish refugees in. So for many years, this issue was kind of dormant and kind of not really treated within Israel. What we have seen in the first years was a few sort of humanitarian gestures. So refugees were accepted into the Israeli society, but sort of outside the Refugee Convention as gestures and demonstrations of goodwill on behalf of Israel. But what we haven't seen was an actual implementation of the legal obligations. Now, as you said, in the mid-2000s, that began to be an issue. And initially, Israel didn't even have a process and a bureaucracy that's needed to deal with asylum applications and so on. So initially, what happened was that the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees was interviewing refugees and making recommendations about their cases to the Israeli Ministry of Interior. That has changed in 2009 when the numbers of people coming in grew so significantly and that the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees was really struggling to interview them all. And since 2009, Israel sort of took over that process of interviewing asylum seekers and making determinations on their cases in an independent manner, much like other states are doing. However, what hasn't changed was sort of like the philosophical framework. And the philosophical framework is that Israel is not a migration state, that Israel is a Jewish state, and therefore refugees who are not Jewish are not welcomed. And what we have seen throughout the years was the creation of a pretty elaborate system of exclusion directed towards non-Jewish refugees, which I imagine we'll talk about in the time that we have left. I'm happy to elaborate, but you might also want to ask us some more questions. So.
Thank you. Mutasim, do you want to talk about that as well?
Yeah, sure. There are always a lot of things to say, of course, about Israel's, Israel and Palestine totally agree that, you know, we've never felt being welcome in Israel, right? Because, you know, for many reasons, of course. But again, looking at the policy, I'm sure Tari will expand on that. You know, all the policies until today are exclusionary policies, right? From, you know, from limiting refugees not to live in certain areas to detention facility, the Holon detention facility when it was erected in 2013, and you know, thousands of refugees from Sudan, mainly these two groups, were detained solely to make their lives miserable so that they could leave Israel voluntarily. And we can also expand on that more. And so, you know, there are really, you know, so many policies. And again, you know, on the other hand, there is no, processing to the asylum claims, right? Like, you could apply for asylum today and you can wait indefinitely without having, you know, the government deciding upon your asylum claim. So on one hand, the government maintains an exclusionary policy to push people out of the country. And on the other hand, even those who apply for asylum, they do not get, interviews or have their asylum claims processed. I'm sure, you know, I'll leave that to Fed for sure to expand on that. Happy to add more.
Great.
So maybe if it's okay, I can extend on that. So I think first and foremost, what Israel does to exclude asylum seekers is it erected a wall along the Egyptian border, which was the longest continental border with Africa, and before 2013 was without any physical barrier. And since 2013, what we've seen is that this is probably the most effective wall in the whole world, because the numbers of people going into Israel just really dropped to zero. So that's the first mechanism. First of all, trying to keep refugees out of the state once they are in Israel. The second mechanism that was used was putting people in immigration detention. And when that was challenged in court, Israel created the residency centers, so to speak, which were essentially very similar to the detention facilities. Another exclusionary effort that Israel carried out in the last couple of years was to try to transfer people to third countries. So Israel realized that the people cannot be sent back to their country of origin. So what it does instead was to create third country agreements, very similar to the ones that the U.S. is currently engaged in, to transfer refugees to third countries. And those two were challenged in court and received significant pushback from the civil society. And ultimately, the attempts to deport people by force to those third countries, which were Rwanda and Uganda, were stopped. In addition, there's, Mutasim mentioned this just now, there's the bureaucratic exclusion. So asylum applications can be pending for a decade or more. Just yesterday, I spoke with a woman whose asylum application is pending for 17 years, and she has yet to hear back a decision on her case. The temporary visas that asylum seekers are given while their asylum applications are pending give them a very partial access to rights, and they constantly need to renew them. So they have this experience of constantly waiting in line to get their papers renewed. There's also the economic exclusion. Since May 2017, mostly, Israel enacted the deposit law, which imposes an obligation on employers to divert 20% of the salary of asylum seekers to a deposit that's made available to them when they leave Israel, which of course for many of them is not a real possibility. On top of all that, there's also the social exclusion. In many aspects, asylum seekers in Israel are really transparent. are really struggling to integrate into the Israeli society with everything else that they're going through in it. Then they also are targeted by politicians in Israel. The most famous incident was in 2012 when Miri Regev, who is now the Minister of Cultural Affairs, referred to Sudanese refugees as the cancer in our bodies. But we've had many more statements along that line. So we have all those pretty elaborate systems of exclusion working together and creating a pretty unbearable situation for the refugees in Israel.
Thank you. Before we continue, I just want to remind our audience to type in some questions. You just need to go to the bottom of your monitor and click on Q&A and click on the icon and type your question in the small box that appears. And this will not disrupt anything, but important to get those in there so that we can ask your questions soon. I wanted to touch a little bit on what you just said, Tali, about sort of refugees integration into Israeli society. And there's been some really astounding grassroots work as well within the community. Mutasim, you've been involved in a lot of that through the ARDC and through the ASO. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about sort of the initiatives that have taken place within the community and also the partnerships that were formed with Israelis on the ground and internationals who were volunteering in Israel and sort of with institutions and how those partnerships played out in helping refugees sort of take part in civil society despite all of the countless things stacked against them.
Right. That's a great question. Thank you so much about that. I want to begin with a slight comment on what, Tali mentioned about exclusionary policies. And I think, just to make sure that everybody's following with us, there's, as Tali mentioned, there's like economic exclusion, deportation, detention, bureaucracy, xenophobia. And actually, a couple of days ago, there was like a sort of flood in Tel Aviv. And the mayor of Tel Aviv actually blamed refugees and asylum seekers, saying, the problem with South Tel Aviv is not the infrastructure, but the infiltrators. This is the mayor of Tel Aviv. And this is just about 3 days when there was a flood in Tel Aviv. And so this is like part of the rhetoric that is going on in Israel, which makes a lot harder for refugees to be there. Now, just to be clear, all of these, exclusionary policies are not unique, I have to say. Speaking of economic exclusion, deposit loan, all of that, Denmark also maintains, economic exclusion, deportation, many countries deport, including the United States. Detention, Australia also detains people, and there are many examples of that. But I think what is unique about the Israeli exclusionary process is like combines all of these together. So it makes it really, really hard for refugees. And that's part of the reason why we see, a number of refugees had, to seek to leave Israel and seek asylum again. And so that's one thing. Speaking of a partnership and the work that we've done in the community, I think, just taking my experience with two organizations, Africa Refugee Development Center, it's like sort of a community-based organization, the idea that, Israelis and asylum seekers came together to help confront the arrival of refugees and asylum seekers because the government does not offer any assistance to this day. And so what happened is that, with the RDC, like African Refugee Development Center in the beginning, the idea was to offer humanitarian assistance, providing shelter, food, and all of these things. But then when they erected the fence in 2012 and no more refugees are coming, we shifted our mission from offering humanitarian assistance to advocacy, right? Like to how can we influence policy? How can we work together with local residents specifically? One of the projects that was really inspired by was, Power to Community. The idea was to bring refugees and asylum seekers and the local residents together. Once one thing that we have, you know, we all acknowledge is that the condition of the local residents in South Tel Aviv, primarily five main neighborhood, Hativa, Neve Sha'anan, Florentine, Kiryat Shalom, and all of these neighborhoods, they really endure miserable situation. Comparing them to other neighborhoods, they're totally ignored and abandoned by the government. And so, we created this project to say that, hey, we acknowledge your pain, your suffering, and we can work together to address these issues, right? Because the government is not doing its, taking its responsibility on handling these issues. In fact, it is, doing everything possible to put these two populations and fight each other. And so under that project, we were able really to conduct several meetings and visit, home visits or patrols and to address the issue of insecurity and all of that. But again, it's like a very limited capacity. It didn't help to solve the issue of refugees, but at least it was an initiative that brings refugees and local residents together. The other thing, myself and a few others who were able to go to Israeli universities, we came up with the initiative that, how can we, help the rest of the community, or at least those who aspire to access, Israeli universities to complete their educations, how can we help them to do so? Because we've had the opportunity, we didn't have a status when we applied for universities, but we were able to do it. Like, we were able to apply for universities. And so we created an organization called African Students Organization. And the idea is, again, to help our friends from the community to go to universities. This is number one thing. And number two, but also to serve as an advocacy organization that just, pool crying people who seek assistance, and we need to give them shelter and food. But people have aspirations just like anybody else, right? Like, we have dreams to achieve. And in fact, many of us were involved with issues back home. And so education is one way to influence both situation in Israel and back home.
And I think I just want to emphasize here that the communities of refugees sort of have spent, especially through the African Refugee Development Center, which Mutasim was once the executive director of and Tali served on the board of, they provided a lot of language classes, and a lot of the refugee community speaks fluent Hebrew now, and their children are enrolled in Israeli schools and speak Hebrew, and more and more higher education is becoming more and more accessible to the refugee community. I wanted to go back to the actual asylum process. Tali, you mentioned before about sort of the convention and the obligations and everything like that. And I think that when looking at the situation in Israel, it's a confusing contradiction, because there's this obvious obligation, and then this sort of mess of a situation. And maybe you can talk a little bit about the connection between what Israel's obligations were on the convention and whether or not they're actually not following those obligations, or are they sort of finding all of these loopholes and sort of other ways to get around standing up to their international obligations?
So I think part of the effort of the Israeli government and Perlman in the last few years was to sort of walk on a very fine line and find the middle grounds of, on the one hand, not granting any rights to the refugees, and on the other hand, not being portrayed as violators of international law. But I think the accumulation of all the exclusionary practices does paint a picture of a country that is evading its obligation under refugee law. Now, the thing is, with the convention relating to the status of refugees from 1951, is that, first of all, it's really vague, and the requirements from states were really drafted in a very vague language. So, for example, when states are supposed to naturalize refugees, the convention requires to facilitate to the extent possible that naturalization. So for Israel, that means, for example, that no refugee will ever be able to obtain a permanent status in Israel, and they will forever be in this prolonged temporariness situation. So that's one way Israel was able to evade its obligations through that very vague language of the convention. But then on the other hand, we should also keep in mind the fact that the Refugee Convention doesn't really have an enforcement mechanism. So when Israel does violate it, there's nothing that actually happens except for the international cry outs and protests. But there are no actual tangible implications of those violations. To me, it seems that Israel is definitely violating the spirit of the convention. I would also say that it's violating specific elements. I think that by making the lives of refugees in Israel so unbearable, Israel is virtually pushing refugees out of the country to places where their lives are at danger. And we've actually seen it, that people have left Israel and went onwards and have reached Libya and either died or found themselves in grave dangers. So I would definitely say that there are violations here. But the thing is, there's virtually no enforcement. There's not much that is being done as a result.
We're very soon going to turn to questions from the audience. So take a moment and write in your question now. We would love to address anything that comes to mind. I wanted to talk about the word solutions is always a funny one in this context, because it is a very unique situation. As both Tali and Mutasim have explained, refugees really aren't coming into the country anymore. You're dealing with a group that's already been there for a very long time, that don't have a status that allows them to really travel. Leaving Israel by foot is almost impossible. And so there's sort of this dealing with this group and sort of trying to think creatively about policies that would help them, sort of encourage them to leave. So the question, and I think that what we've seen over the past couple of years, a lot of members of the refugee community who were leaders in the grassroots movement and speak Hebrew and Mutasim. But don't necessarily see a future for themselves there anymore. And there's an increasingly people are looking for opportunities to leave because it's just sort of policy after policy, which basically says don't stay here. And I'm curious for both of your thoughts on this. Are we looking at a time where it's sort of just going to trickle and trickle and trickle until everybody leaves, and then we don't necessarily have a solved policy issue. Israel will just not deal with asylum cases, or are we looking at hopefully sort of small steps towards a hopefully better system in the future? Mutasim, why don't we start with you?
All right, thanks. This is actually one of the most difficult questions right now, because this, in the beginning, it was a lot easier to handle the issue of refugees and asylum seekers, right? But then because of the xenophobic, xenophobia and, labeling refugees and infiltrators, work infiltrators, in fact, dehumanizing the community and makes them feel like they're not, belonging to Israel. It's becoming really difficult, even from refugees' part, to be in Israel, right? But it's still, I want to be hopeful as well. In 2018, there was a deal that was actually signed between the Israeli government, Netanyahu's government, and the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. The substance of the deal was to sort of half of refugees. Then it was about 16,200 people to settle them to third countries. It wasn't defined specifically what those third countries are, but the indications were basically Western countries. And the other half will remain in Israel. People, Southern Israel, being given a durable status to remain in Israel and live and work, live in a dignified way. Unfortunately, less than a day, Benjamin Netanyahu canceled the deal, only because some of the local residents who were politically motivated protested and said this is like a bad deal and all of them, so the deal was canceled. So I really hope, that deal will be reinstated, though the United Nations High Commission for Refugees says, yes, we are prepared to do that again. I don't know how likely it is the Israeli government will do so. I don't know if Netanyahu's government is willing to do that after the elections, but we're looking forward to see what's going to happen. But again, I have to say, for not necessarily speaking for all the refugees in Israel, but I can tell you a lot of people just want to leave Israel. And this is not only because of their status, but because of the way that people are being treated, being referred to as criminals, as rapists, and all of that. And so it will dehumanize and pejorative, and that's part of the reason why a lot of people want to seek another safe place.
Thank you. I'm actually going to turn to the Q&A for a moment. This is a question from an anonymous attendee. Thank you for your work. I get that right-wing Israeli politicians like to demonize the refugees, but how do regular Israelis react to this? Do they buy into the scare tactics? And how do the centrist and left-wing parties relate to this issue? Tali, would you like to take that one?
Sure. So I think the answer is that it depends. I think some people do buy into the scare tactics, but I also think a lot of people don't. And I think Mutasim described the attempt in 2018 to deport people to Rwanda and Uganda. That was a very sad moment for me as an Israeli to see what my government was trying to do. But it was also a very hopeful and encouraging moment to see how the population of the state of Israel responded. In the protests to the deportation plans, we saw tens of thousands of people going out to the streets, marching alongside with asylum seekers against the deportation. So I'm not saying that all of those tens of thousands of people have a concrete idea of how they want to see refugees integrated into the Israeli society or anything like that, but these are people who are willing, to take the time and get out there, and it's not very comfortable necessarily to protest in Israel and so on, but these were people who were willing to go out there and say that this should not be done in their name. That's something that I think is really hopeful. I also think that there are so many non-governmental organizations, both of asylum seekers and Israelis, that are, investing so much of their time, effort, and expertise in assisting asylum seekers in Israel, that's also really encouraging. We see some support from the political parties, but not a whole lot of it. Mostly the Joint List and Meretz have been on board with asylum seekers' rights issues. But politically speaking, it's not perceived to be very wise to side with asylum seekers' rights issues. Asylum seekers cannot vote, so they don't have any political power. And on the other side, there are people who think about this issue as very controversial. So a lot of the political parties are just, sort of staying out of this issue altogether.
Mutasim, would you like to comment a little bit about sort of collaborations and sort of work that you've done with communities on that regard?
Yeah, sure. So just speaking of the, average Israeli and the rhetoric and all of that, I can tell you, as Tali mentioned, there are a lot of people a lot of Israelis who support the cause of refugees and asylum seekers. We were able to partner, right? I'm not only speaking of organizations, human rights organizations, right? They are often labeled as leftists. And so, you know, our partnership extends even with the Israeli people, right? Like, let's say, Achuti movement in South Tel Aviv, which is sort of a feminist Mizrahi organization in South Tel Aviv for the rights of local residents, right? And so, you know, there are a lot of questions. Part of the reason why we were able to have a big protest in February 2018 that Tali was speaking of, about, you know, almost 20,000 people came to the protest, and that's because of that partnership. But again, to the question of whether, you know, the majority of Israelis support the asylum seekers or not, that's really difficult to answer. But I think my belief is that the vast majority of Israelis are buying into the government's policy, right? You know, there are people who just believe these are not refugees, they're infiltrators, they're here to destroy our society. This is something that we hear all the time, everywhere. But you know, once again, we really do not have many options other than working with those who can, you know, are willing to discuss this, because there are a lot of people, there are some people just unwilling to even talk about this. And so our partnerships are primarily with those who are willing to speak, willing to listen, you know, having conversations and debates and all of that, and organize events where possible. And but in the end, we've been doing that, and I have to say this, like, with honesty, we've been doing this for many years. Like, since I've involved with these issues, it was 2010. Now it's up to 10 years since I started involving with the issue of mobilizing the local residents and refugees to work together and partner and all of that. Yet we do not see, because in the end, the idea of this part, you know, a policy that will be good for all, be good for refugees, but also for the local residents, for, specifically in South Tel Aviv. Did we make change? Unfortunately not, because the situation is actually getting worse, at least from the end of refugees and asylum seekers. People are still being deported voluntarily. People still do not have the status. The government is not even willing to process the claims. And so it's still the same things that we were speaking of, you know, back in days when the first refugees decided to arrive. In fact, it's even worse today.
Thank you. Another question, is what is or will be the status of children of refugees born in Israel? Tali, can I come to you on this?
Sure. So Israel doesn't have birthright citizenship. So unlike the U.S., children of non-citizens will not be citizens just by the virtue of being born in Israel. So children of refugees and migrant workers are undocumented, basically. In the case of children of refugees, they are dependent on their parents' asylum application, which, as we've mentioned before, could take, you know, 10, 15 years to even be processed. What we've seen in the last few months is an attempt to deport children who are undocumented with their families, but that was an attempt that was focused more on the children of the migrant workers. It's still something I find really concerning. Another development of the last few days is the decision of the Tel Aviv municipality to open a school for the foreign children, as they call them. And that school is supposed to be opened on the only park that is still available in South Tel Aviv. So not only is this a decision that suggests deepening or entrenching the segregation in education and sending non-national kids to separate schools, this is also something that has such a direct cost for the local residents of South Tel Aviv, that in itself is not something that will encourage the residents of South Tel Aviv to be more tolerant towards the Italian-speaking population. So that's something that I find really concerning and problematic.
There's a comment here from David Abraham. He says, strategically, it seems to me there is some confusion or ambivalence between, on the one hand, playing the Jewish card based on our own tragic experience, we should be generous towards the persecuted, and on the other hand, stressing the normality and success of Israel that should enable it to be comfortable taking some refugees from around the world. I think it's actually an important comment. Maybe Tali, you can continue with this a little bit. Just sort of the idea of, not taking all the refugees, but actually taking some. Is that even a possibility for Israel? But maybe.
I think the question for Israel to deal with is what is the lesson or the moral lesson that we're learning from our past. One way to sort of formulate that lesson is to say never again for anyone. And another way is to say never again for us. And I think the strategic choice of the current Israeli government, and unfortunately the governments that came before as well, was to formulate the question, the lesson as never again for us. And for some people that meant excluding non-Jewish migrants, including non-Jewish refugees. To me, that's really not the lesson that we should be learning. Now, especially since Israel is located in that region where it's located, right? I mean, we're right next to Syria, with everything that Syria is going through. We're right next to Lebanon, that has been shouldering such a significant portion of the responsibility. Jordan, Turkey, all the countries in this region are either in massive turmoil or shouldering much more significant portions of their responsibility towards refugees in the world. And then we have the state of Israel, which currently have just about 30,000 refugees at hand. It's a pretty economically stable country. It's a democracy. And yet it's struggling to provide rights and protection to 30,000 people. You know, I mean, for me as an Israeli, that's something that I'm really not proud of. And for me as someone whose family has survived the Holocaust, that's not the lesson we should have learned from this experience.
Mutasim, would you like to comment on that at all?
Yeah, sure. A very quick comment. I think, just for, taking the last part of the comment that was made by David, I think I totally agree that was, what Tali said. But I think there's one thing. And as we're not speaking of daily influx, not daily arrival of refugees and asylum seekers, because the fence was already erected. And actually, from 2018 to 2019, zero people entered Israel, right? Like, we're not speaking of taking more refugees. We're speaking of how can we handle those who are already within the territories of Israel. And this is only 29,000, 600 people that Israel can, as Tali said, the economic power, and actually, the government and Netanyahu particularly always brags about how powerful the state of Israel is. And indeed, it's true, I agree with him. And I think it is capable of taking 29,000 refugees and asylum seekers. So there shouldn't be a fear of, resettling those already in Israel. This is number one thing. Number two, and unlike other countries, right, Israel, even if you're granted refugee status to citizenship in Israel, because citizenship, to be a citizen in Israel, you have to be a Jewish. And so, I have the refugee status, but I do not have any chance to be a citizen of Israel. And I don't complain about that, because in the end, for me, the goal is not to be a citizen. The goal is to, in the end, just to, to have a safe shelter until I'm able to be back to my home.
Thank you. And there's one more question. Here, a little bit abroad, but can you give a moment? Can you give us a sense of how this issue is being handled in other countries compared to Europe, for instance, and also in terms of US policy? Ali?
Yeah, so it's a little bit broad, but I'll try to give some highlights maybe. So I think a lot of the aspects of the policies in Israel are really not unique to Israel. We've seen other countries erecting border fences. We've seen other countries detaining asylum seekers. But I think there are two things that are different with Israel. First of all, there are like tiny adjustments that Israel makes that make all of those mechanisms really difficult. So for example, with respect to immigration detention, so, I mean, you know, small things like not detaining just the people who just enter the country, but also detaining people who have been in the country sometimes for, you know, a decade or so. That is something that is pretty unusual in a comparative sense. The border fence I've mentioned before is the most effective, so to speak, border fence in the world. But, you know, part of it has to do with our geopolitical situation because of the fact that it's located right near Gaza and it's so heavily militarized in a way that few countries can. But what I think really makes Israel stand out is the fact that it applies all of these exclusionary mechanisms together. You know, the fact that there is that border fence, the immigration detention, third country agreements, and the very low recognition rates combined with the economic exclusion and the 20% deduction from the salary, the bureaucratic hurdles that people have to cross, and the strong xenophobic language, all of those really make Israel stand out, just that mere combination of factors. I do have to say, though, that the Israeli Supreme Court has been quite active in sort of pushing back some of these initiatives. And at the same time, that sort of backfired on the court, and the court is now in a really difficult position that the legitimacy of the court is sort of questioned because of the many times that the court has struck down policies towards asylum seekers in Israel.
All right. Thank you. I think we're coming to a close. Thank you to everybody who submitted questions. Maybe one more minute to come back to our panelists. Mutasim, would you like to just 30
yeah.
seconds?
Yeah, well, I mean, a sort of, there were two questions. I sort of want to see that just to feel like, you know, not to miss anyone, like the two main things, and I'm going to do that very fast. I'm starting with Marcia Yerman. So she was asking a really important question about the alliance, or, you know, if there is a connection between refugee struggle and migrant workers in the Philippines and all of that. Unfortunately, we haven't done that because we believe that we have totally separate issues. We did not, you know, come to Israel in a regular way. And so it was just completely different. We also claim persecution for political reasons and all of that. Of course, you know, the way they're treated in certain extent similar to ours, but our issues are completely different. This is number one thing. Number two, you know, migrant workers have work permits, right? Like they come to Israel under contracts, and so they have really valid visas. And here's one thing that I want to say in the end, that most of refugees and asylum seekers do not have work permits, right? Like they have conditional release visa that they have to renew every you know, month or once in 2 months, for instance, let's say. These are the one of the, you know, just a piece of paper, and it says clearly it does not constitute a work permit. This is one of the issues. But in the end, to conclude my remarks, perhaps first of all, I really hope that you enjoyed this conversation. There are a lot of things, of course, you know, this issue is so broad and so big and cannot, you know, cover everything in this, you know, short meeting, but I hope for the future conversations we'll be able to expand on this more. I do believe that there are a lot of good people, Israelis, but also people in diaspora, right? Like they made, like people in diaspora made a gigantic difference, especially during the deportation campaign. And your involvement makes a big difference. Like now, the one of the reasons why we do not see active deportation of refugees and asylum seekers because of the campaigns. One of the reasons why, and I actually forgot to say this, there are a number of, dozens of Darfuris who granted, sort of temporary residency status. And because of the, Israeli government sort of embarrassed by the fact that, hey, we have Darfuris on our land and yet they don't have the status. And, Jewish diaspora protested for many years for the cause of war. And now the Israeli government does not give the status to Darfur. So that's because of your advocacy, some of the Darfuris are able to receive the status. And so what I'm trying to say in the end is that your involvement, your engagement with this issue for the good of Israel, but also for the good of asylum seekers can make a big difference. Thank you so much.
Tali, would you like to say 15 seconds of a conclusion?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with Mutasim. I think that a lot of us might feel discouraged from dealing with the Israeli-Palestinian issue. I think this is one issue that is really easy to resolve. It's a very small population that Israel could easily take in and accept and could actually benefit from. A lot of the asylum seekers could actually be contributing members of the Israeli society, so it could really be something that works for the mutual benefit of everyone. But thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to talk about it now, and we're really looking forward to your future involvement in this topic.
Wonderful. Thank you all for joining us for this conversation with Israel and Palestine. I want to thank our panelists, Mutasim Ali and Dr. Tali Kutzman-Amir. Also, thank you to the staff of Partners for Progressive Israel for their work in making this discussion happen. You can go to progressiveisrael.org to learn more about Partners for Progressive Israel and their future programs. Thank you all for your questions and participation. Thank you to the panelists.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.